history as opposed to extremism and inventions.
Now, earlier in our talk, you mentioned gun shows. I was covering the Iowa caucuses, and our photographer and I stumbled on a big gun show that was happening just outside where the Iowa caucuses were taking place, where 23 of the presidential candidates all spoke within 2 days. And at that gun show, you could buy just about anything. And so one of our listeners asked the question about gun show loopholes and can they be closed? Is that something where there could be legislation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That could be closed, right? And part of what the plan, according to the NRA, Biden's plan would end private transfers of weapons. This is a problem and a legitimate problem for a father who wants to give his father's weapon, his father's hunting rifle, right, a Remington BDL Deluxe, for instance, to his son. And I think that's to be respected. You don't want to belittle that. But you don't want private transfers of guns at gun shows. So that could be imposed. But the problem is the ATF, which is the federal agency, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and now explosives, in charge with enforcing national gun control laws, has been so weakened and so beaten by congressional attacks. The degree of federal enforcement to enforce gun control has been limited by Congress itself. So all this would have to change, right? Including, which is starting to happen, allowing the Centers for Disease Control to look at gun violence like a pandemic. Mm-hmm. All these things need to be done in concert. And the NRA has on its own terms, been successful at keeping this all at bay, saying, if you yield on any one of them, the whole house of cards will collapse. And the rest of the society pays the price. And now I think there's potential to turn that around, but it's going to take a while.
You mentioned the CDC, and of course, it's probably been a decade or more since Physicians for Social Responsibility took up gun violence as a public health issue, and I know other groups have as well. What's the chance of something like that getting more traction with the public in general?
Well, I think if studies can come out and you can demonstrate the link between gun ownership and guns in circulation and gun laws and violence, you can go a long way. But here's the problem. And this is another way to look at it. What the NRA has done, part of the blinders they put on, is that they are comfortable with largely the 1934 law. They don't want to admit it because it bans fully automatic weapons. And they don't want to admit that they're comfortable with that, but they're largely comfortable with that. They're largely comfortable with the way the United States regulates wholesale firearms commerce. Right. They don't have a big problem with that. And they've weakened some of the provisions. So firearms dealers are less likely have less penalties facing them if they do something on the margins. What separates the United States from other nations, other advanced nations, is that we don't have any national regulation of any meaning to speak of to regulate retail gun sales. And that's really what we're fighting about, though nobody's ever thought to think of it that way because of the blinders. Because what can happen now is I can drive to West Virginia and buy $8,000 worth of weapons, pay a local resident a few thousand dollars to buy them for me, and then drive to Detroit or Chicago or another city and then sell them on the black market. Not for that much of a markup because it's so easy to do. A lot of people do it. And this is what's fueling crime guns, as the ATF calls them when they confiscate them. That's what's fueling. That's why a lot of the statistics put out by NRA paid scholars are totally misleading because they're looking at apples and oranges. Yeah, you know, gun laws are restricted in one place, but they're not strict somewhere else. When you have open borders, it doesn't work. And that's why I would like to see more research on gun control and gun violence or the lack thereof in other advanced nations, because that would be a real comparison.
Every time we have one of these tragic mass shootings, there's an outcry for action. And every time we see people in Congress sort of backpedaling and saying, you know, yes, we should do something, but then in fact they don't. What is the tipping point that will make the difference?
Well, I hope the tipping point is not another horrific tragedy or a series of horrific tragedies. And I'm afraid that that may be the road we're headed down. I'm hoping that more information and challenging the NRA and the gun rights extremists on their myths could help precipitate that tipping point. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're at the tipping point. We're closer right? The gun reform movement is closer than they've ever been, but the nation is not yet at the tipping point. But I'm not sure what that would be, except for the gun reform movement to get stronger over time.
And your predictions as we close here on the both the bankruptcy case in New York State and now the case that just been opened up in Texas?
I think the NRA is going to get clobbered in New York State. If it doesn't seek to dissolve them, they're going to end up dissolving themselves. And they're going to just try and fight it out to preserve as much of their assets in Virginia as they can. But their attempt to move to Texas is going to take a while. But I think they will eventually reincorporate under a new federal tax ID so they could change the name. It would still be the NRA, but it also would have different bylaws. So it'd really be a big deal. And I think that the bankruptcy proceeding is going to be at least frozen until the New York Attorney General lawsuit is concluded. And we're also seeing there was division in the board of the NRA, and then they sealed ranks. And now it seems like the division is starting to creep out again with this ex-board member quoting other board members unnamed in his filing asking for an independent examiner. And the NRA is also spending tens of millions of dollars, you know, Rudy Giuliani type legal fees on their lawyers, right, to be able to defend themselves in three arenas. And then that's not sustainable in the long run either, right? So they're going down, but their ideology will remain.
That was Frank Smyth, the NRA Unmasked. He spoke on February 14th at an online event moderated by Norm Stockwell of the Progressive magazine. Frank Smyth is an award-winning independent journalist and the author of The NRA, The Unauthorized History. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of this program, Frank Smyth, The NRA Unmasked, and our special book offer, A Brief History of Fascist Lies by Federico Finkelstein, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. We're offering free of charge MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to a broadcast of Ebony Spectrum from our archives. This interview features a talk with Derek Chisholm. This happened maybe about 3 years ago, in 2018, I believe. And we heard some interesting things from Derek back then. And of course, things have changed, but it's real interesting to see what her path was back then. And she's continued to go upward and onward with her career, and now she's hosting more TV. Listen to the conversation. You'll find it very interesting. This is Ebony Spectrum from 2018 with Daria Chisholm. Rick takes the lead as he adds the questions.
One thing, say I'm going to write or I'm going to perhaps get on television, which is enough of a, takes a modicum, and I'm being a little bit facetious here with that. It takes more than a modicum, actually, to go into that profession. Because you got to have a lot of confidence,
You have to have a lot of confidence. You have to have a lot of courage. You also have to have a lot of commitment. And for me, it's always been about being a creative. And a lot of the work that I do as an entrepreneur now is really as a coach supporting other business owners who are looking to become more visible and branding their message, their mission, and using multimedia strategies. I was very fortunate, as you're aware, that I've had a long history in television, but because I also had varying businesses, I learned a lot of practical tools. And so I've been able to marry what it means to be an entrepreneur, particularly a solopreneur in this space of online marketing, and really look at what are some sizable visibility strategies that people can use. So that's really where that came together from. In terms of this issue of courage and the courage to have your own business, and as you said, you know, you got to hustle for a paycheck, period. I mean, and I think there's, as an entrepreneur, you have to have that as your modicum for success. It's the only paycheck that's going to happen is the one that you're going to go out and make. And so as an entrepreneur, and I'm sure any of them listening, completely get that part of your drive for success, I believe, should first be what it is that you love doing or serving, and let the money follow. And I get it. When you got to pay some bills, it's like, no, we need to think about the money first. But you will be a much happier entrepreneur going after your dream, hustling for that success, and of course, working hard for the money, but realizing that the part of the reason that you're doing it is because you absolutely love being the entrepreneur that you are. And that helps when you get to those periods in time, and we've all been there, when the money isn't flowing. Because it's easy. I mean, I've had jobs all my life, and it's important, obviously, if you do the type of work that you're not an entrepreneur, that you do a really good job at your job. Right. But if you truly have a desire to strike out on your own and run that business that you've been dreaming about, or pursue that dream that only you can do because it's like busting in your belly, then go for it. Go for it with everything that you have.
It's interesting. Your book, you used the word hustle. You've used it several times. And I think probably people think of, when you say hustle, guy, girl on the street.
That's your generation.
Doing the hustling thing, right? And I mean, I always never put the total negative kind of label.
Yeah.
Some people did, because I always recognized people got to survive.
Right.
And everything that was being hustled wasn't necessarily illegal. It was not mainstream.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's a word that over a period of time has had multiple meanings. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. I think if you look 40, 50, 60 years ago, hustle had a very negative connotation. It often was equated with the person who, you know, was just trying to jack somebody out of some money or out of a service, right? Or eluding something. And it certainly had a negative connotation. Then there's the hustle, the dance. And so people kind of see the jolly part in that. And then, of course, there's a hustle that you know, parents, when their kids are out on the baseball field or basketball, hustle, get down the court, you know, make it happen. Mm-hmm. But what we've seen, I would say, in the last 5 to 10 years, particularly with the explosion of people doing business on the internet and being self-employed as an infopreneur, that more people are using the term hustle that is really synonymous with working hard, enjoying what you're doing, and moving towards success. And so it's embraced in a different way, particularly by, and I teased you a second ago because I said that's your generation, a younger generation embraces the word hustle in an entirely different way. I use it, and I use it with, because obviously the name of my book is Hustle. I have a video podcast show called Hustle and Heart. And so I am very aware that it takes hard work. It takes grind. It takes a hustle in order to, or hustling, if you will, in terms of working hard to make something happen. But I always am conscious of the fact that the heart part, the reason why you do it, the love that you have, the passion that you have for your particular project or your business is what balances out all of that hard work. Mm-hmm. So that's why I love the use of the term hustle and heart.
Well, I figured, particularly with the podcast and the title of the book, that you had put a lot of thought into that. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting choice. And as I said, one thing I look at a lot of people, not necessarily young, I'll say new also, who go into a job a lot of times, and sometimes even business, and they just don't have their head on right. You know, you hear the ones who go into business like, yes, I'm going to go into business for myself, and then at 5 o'clock I can go home and I can. No. I don't know anybody. And you can talk about that.
I work harder now than ever before.
Thank you. And the other thing is where people think they can kind of just show up and that's enough. You know, you should be happy I'm there. And if I do a mediocre little job, what's the beef? And I'm here. Pay me my, you know, give me my check. And so the notion that you got to hustle, I as my first love is organizing. And so I always talk about doing a stunt or an angle or something, which sounds like the kind of language a shyster or something would use. But I use it in the sense that you look for opportunities. And the only difference is I didn't wish I did it, had done it for financial gain, but more for political social gain as a community organizer. I would recognize times that I could pull something off because of the conditions, and that would be my stunt. And I would have great satisfaction, whether anybody knew I had anything to do with it or not, when one demonstration sometimes has 10 or 20 people, and then one day there's 1,000 people, you know, and let others wonder, how'd that happen? Well, it's not magic, but there is an art and somewhat of a science, but it's a skill. And I suspect in business, the timing and knowing how to choose opportunities, the change in media, you know, again, visibility and media strategists, that sounds like a very modern type of term. Mm-hmm. And I have a dear friend who's a journalist, and we've often talked. In fact, we had him on the show, Doug Lyons, mm-hmm. used to be at the Washington Post in different places, talking about this convergence where you can't just be a writer. You now have to do the podcast or the video piece, and that it has totally revolutionized the whole industry, if you will, of communications. And I just wonder how you dealt with that. Was it a natural to take to the different platforms that are now available that one can use, as opposed to saying, well, I'm a TV journalist, I'm a print writer, reporter. How have you adapted to that?
Part of my adaptation really is because as you're aware, as I just said, spent a lot of time in media growing up. And so as I'm aware, and most people are in traditional media, is that most people these days are listening to podcasts or watching videos online on YouTube. They are subscribing to certain apps and getting what they need at the drop of the hat, as opposed to waiting until, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock at night to watch it. And they are subscribing to blogs. So they have found their way into what you refer to as new media. Mm-hmm. And as an entrepreneur who's always looking for a way to get to a particular audience and send a message of empowerment, it to me only makes sense to use those media platforms mm-hmm. to reach my audience. Even if I had never been in television, I'm sure that I would be leveraging something as it relates to new media, as we term it. So it could have been a podcast, it would have been videos, it would have been Facebook Lives, you know, the various social media platforms, having a website. You know, those are all online things, but then there are a number of things that I would encourage entrepreneurs to do offline, and that, of course, would be to speak, to go to networking events, to hold their own workshops, retreats, events, to engage their particular audience. It really does take a multi-prong approach when you use the word media and you're using it from the sense of being an entrepreneur in order to find your ideal client or customer or person who's going to buy your product or service. Nowadays, we have access to all of that at a relatively low cost. The barrier to entry, is a lot lower. Okay. And you can learn it, you can teach it, you can get a coach, you can take a class, you can literally create your own media at any particular time. And mm-hmm. and never have we been in that place, right? Never have we had it. You know, the internet certainly opened us up to that capability. So I love this space that we're in, particularly for smaller business owners or entrepreneurs, or what I call solopreneurs, because you can create your own media and get your message out whenever you want, however you want, to whomever you want.
So you got both ends, the production and the content.
Exactly.
Which is really totally mm-hmm. new, revolutionary, actually, I would say, in terms of what folks can do, definitely. Brother Amos.
Yeah, but the hard part
I often joke about them not putting his mic on.
The hard part is administering all that, getting all that together, you know, because you got to, like, break everything down and say, well, we're going to start doing this. Because, as you know, the production part comes easy. You can just jump up here and, like, do it, you know, and read off a piece of paper or whatever, or write a script. But, you know, putting all that together is the hardest part. And Rick and I both know that from doing this for a few years ourselves. You know, you have to, like, really be able to break it down. People say, well, why don't you start a new radio station? I say, well, it's not that easy. you gotta do a whole bunch of other things before you can even, you know, even go on the air. So, you know.
Well, and I would agree with you. And I think that's, but where I'll disagree is that production doesn't have to be hard in this day and age, right. Particularly with the internet.
Yeah,
and
we use a lot of tools.
I mean, I just left Mike Wysocki's show, and it was on Facebook and broadcast across a couple of different mediums.
Mm-hmm.
You can reach a lot of people very quickly, just like we're doing right now, with a relatively small budget and small production value. Now, when you grow and you want more, then obviously you're going to need to invest some more dollars and time and energy. But part of it also is to be thinking about strategy and what is going to be your best tool to leverage to reach your particular audience. It may not be doing videos. It may, in fact, be doing a podcast or doing a radio program. You might be more inclined to get on the road and do things offline and more in a room or in an auditorium, which, you know, I still, no matter what, as much as I know that you can move very quickly on the internet, believe in the power of people working face-to-face in groups and in rooms. And so, you know, whether you are hosting a small workshop where there's 5 or 10 people, or you're engaging 500 people or 1,000 people in an auditorium or a theater, people still want to connect. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, you've got to know where your audience is and how best to communicate with them.
That's been surprising to me. Several times I've said to folk, the media, internet, and other computer-mediated technology, if you asked me some years ago, I would say it would be divisive. It would make people loners. It would really kind of tear down community. And I've been fascinated. Facebook, actually, I have found myself community and family, because now I communicate with folks that, I hate to say it, but I probably would never communicate with, because I'm not going to write a letter, the old style. You know, I can count on one hand how many letters I've written in my life versus how many emails, texts, and other things that I've sent. And what I find is people, whether it's around weddings, the birth of a child, class reunions, what have you, they're is a ready-made platform for people to kind of form community in ways that was not there before.
I love the internet for that reason. And, you know, the traditional way I think people understand community, particularly with social media, would be like Facebook groups.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of people who engage in a Facebook group and really have their opinions heard and voiced, and they get the support that they need, and I think that's tremendous. But there are lots of other platforms that you can use to build community online. What I enjoy the most about that is your ability to connect with people all over the world. And I have a very strong network of people that are on my team, literally on the team that I have in place for a documentary that I'm filming and a social justice project that I'm working on. And, you know, I get excited every single day because I could be speaking to someone in Hong Kong, in Austria, in France, in parts of Europe, you know, and then throughout the various places in the United States. And I know we are in constant communication through the community that we're building, but because of because of technology through Skype and other aspects. So we have a lot to be appreciative for with the internet in the good spaces, and then there's some not so good spaces, but it's nonetheless, it's still a great tool and resource for, you know, and I keep moving, running down this entrepreneur space because that's where I spend a lot of time. But just, you know, for people in general, families who want to stay in contact with them, another friends. I mean, think of the number of people who have been able to find long lost friends, you know, through social media. And years ago, if we didn't have these platforms, we wouldn't be able to do that.
Or if you did it, you would do it much slower.
Yeah, you'd be writing letters and
going to courthouses, looking at paper archives and stuff,
there you go.
Trying to find connections.
Well, you're going to tell our age in a moment.
A lot of folks.
I'm speaking for myself.
A lot of folks want to know how to get in contact with us, and they might want to talk to Derek on the air. And the number here at the station at WRCT is area code 412-268-9728. That's area code 412-268-9728. It's around 6:28, and you're listening to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT.
I believe this isn't anything particularly witty on my part or any badge of intellect, but I believe this is the time of the woman. From the presidential election, which didn't really turn out that well from that standpoint, but even social movements. And I look at what's going on with Black Lives Matter, for example, and I look at it in my youth with the Black Power Civil Rights Movement, which was very much a male-driven thing up front. Now, the true story is the women behind Malcolm and Martin and all, they were doing the work anyway. And the stories of Ella and Fanny and Angela and different ones that were doing the key organizing and the backbone that without that, the movement wouldn't have been there. But there was very much of the Black male asserting himself to say, I am a man. They had signs back there. I am a man. It was a quest for dignity as well as empowerment. Now I see the script flipped. And so we got social movement. And I was putting on media, probably around the time of Ferguson and stuff, a very powerful picture of a sister coming forward. I'm trying to think what she had in her hand now. But the police, that there were about three officers in front of her. And they almost looked like they were run up on her and they were kind of stepping back. And she had this flowing dress on. And it just looked like she was a goddess and that they were like being repelled. And I used it several times because I thought it was it invoked what was going on at that moment. And a lot of the leadership, I went to a retreat. I was fortunate to go for Black Lives Matter. And a lot of the leaders are Black women and the LGBTQIA community. So it's a whole different kind of thing happening that back in the day when none of that happened at all. In fact, it was rather chauvinistic and misogynist. Do you see that? Do you see that difference in the communications, media, business world? And is it just something in the United States or you see it also in the world?
I love the way you term this. And that is, we really are in the time of the woman and the voices of women who are now being heard, particularly around the issues of sexual assault and abuse, are heard even louder than ever before. And I think what's happened is we've reached a watershed, a tipping point, where there is a safety net of sorts that is been intertwined by other women who say, it's okay for you to speak out. Mm-hmm. It's okay for you to be heard and to end your shame and end your silence. And we couldn't be at a better time to do that, particularly because on the opposite of that, I think we sense there's this heightened sense of, lack of understanding around what it means to be vocal on an issue that makes sense for you. And so more women are saying, yes, what we have to say matters. We are not going to stand for the abuse. Me too. I mean, all of those hashtags in this movement that define where we are is a prevalent time. You asked if I think that I see this happening internationally. I would say to some degree, yes. And the only reason why I can say that is I have my finger on the pulse of a few communities that represent women who are in business, who represent an international voice. And, you know, from across the pond, across the water, they are saying, yes, this is our time as well. And it's good and for good reason. And, you know, it's we have to stand at this time and we have to have our voices heard, because if not, you remain in that silent place, which for the victim can be so shaming and alarming and embarrassing and crippling in many ways. So I call this everyday courage. We're in the moment of what I call everyday courage. And for those of us who have had the courage to speak out about any form of assault or abuse, find ourselves wrapped in the pure essence of, yes, we can do this together.
I am Kevin, and I've had several different shows, different people, where the issues confronting women have come up. And, of course, we are gender challenged as men. And one of the things I've always said to my brothers, I know they're struggling. Some of us are, like, rather Neanderthalic. Is that a word? Anyway, I made it up. But I would say two things. One, I took a week and watched television. I said, as best I can, I'm going to watch television standpoint if I were a woman. Mm. So what kind of characters would I see? Are they the main character? Would I like to play that role? How are they portrayed? What happens to them? I was horrified because I almost had to, and I don't really, on you know, issues of blackness, I don't back up on too much. I looked at stuff and I was like, dang, this women get treated worse than black people. Now, obviously, there's black women, and now, thank goodness, more in the media and in movies and starring and everything. But the portrayal kind of like shocked me about all the violence and just, I mean, it was like terrible. The other thing I thought, now I'll say this because a lot of times men will get into our little macho thing. And I said, well, imagine now every time you prepared to leave a house, not all the time, but many times people would say, well, don't leave the house. Or if you leave, leave with somebody. Or at night, you know, you might not want to go out. That's like a foreign notion to most males. Now, you just live in the worst neighborhood in the world. We wouldn't stand for such a thing. So as much as possible, I'm saying, brothers, put your self in the shoes of your significant other, your sister, your mother, your wife, your girl, whatever, to kind of understand the world. Almost like we have done to those who are non-black to try to explain, well, you don't walk this, so you don't even see what's going on.
You know, I'll take this a step further, and I'll challenge the men that are listening to also speak up at this time. Mm-hmm. And I mean speak up in the sense that in the sense of defense, in their masculinity, to say, we are not going to allow our women to be treated this way. Mm-hmm. That for those of you all who are assaulting, abusing, intimidating, bullying women, we are not going to stand for it, not on our watch. And because women, with our own degree of feminine power, are obviously speaking out, but there is something to be said that when a man hears another man say, stop, that's not tolerated, it changes the dynamics. Absolutely. And I really believe that when we get more men who are speaking up on behalf of those women who have spoken up, we'll really see a change.
That's a very powerful point. You have a website and an advocacy organization, 50 Shades of Silence. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So 50shadesofsilence.com and the entire social justice project, 50 Shades of Silence, is a global movement to give voice and dignity to victims of cyber harassment and online crimes. And I can open that up to extend it to victims of any form of assault or abuse, simply because the use of the word silence in the top and the title has so much. And when I say shades of silence, I'm talking layers of silence, whether this the victim has experienced years of abuse and or assault or attack, or the people around them are not speaking up about it, or they can't get the help or the support that they need to move through this process, or they can't find the right legal remedies to support them, or the perpetrators are running free and continuing their acts of violence. So when I say shades of silence, it literally runs the scope of that. But the movement in particular, as we narrow in on cyber harassment, really extends in this world of cyberspace and what's happening and the number of victims who every single day face cyberbullying, revenge porn, or what's commonly referred to as non-consensual pornography, luring, human trafficking. It extends across all those barriers. And most of it is fortified online, on the internet. Mm-hmm. What's worse, in my opinion, is we have very few laws on the books to adequately protect victims and better prosecute perpetrators. We also face a time and age where online companies are not as responsive as they need to be in terms of removing material quickly and advocating for those victims. And then we're also in a place where I think we really need to look at what it means to become socially responsible when it comes to texting, posting, and sharing. There's this sense of we've lost our filters, I think, is we're so used to seeing so much stuff online that it doesn't shock us anymore. It's not a big deal. It's okay, you know. And so we post, share, and comment without realizing the potential of damage that it could be doing to the victim. You know, and we realize as well that there are alarming suicide rates among victims who have been harassed online. Because part of this is that while, you know, you can be bullied on a playground or you can experience some sort of abuse that's physical and that hurts clearly. And You know, you may live with those scars internally, even when the ones externally end. But if there's some sort of content, whether it's videos or pictures or images that are online, that exposure continues for years. And the eyeballs that see it, the number of people who see it and share it, right, to the victim feels like what I call gang rape.
Mm.
I mean, I'm just using in my own personal case, and lots, you know, if you don't know my story and you're listening, I unfortunately am a recent survivor of revenge porn, cyber sexual assault. I had an ex-boyfriend who I was living with in Jamaica take several photos and videos of me sleeping naked. And when I ended the relationship and didn't want to have anything to do with him, several months later, he called and threatened me. He told me that he would kill me if I didn't return to the relationship. And when he couldn't do that, he decided to use those images and try and exact revenge on me, mm-hmm, and force me to come back by sharing those messages. And these threats went on for several months with lots of text messages. I have tons of evidence and information against him saying, hey, take a look at this video. Look at what I'm going to put out. Now, I mean, obviously, he, as he said to me, I'm going to silence and destroy you, knew that I was quite fearful of any of that being exposed, given my celebrity and credibility and work in this community. And so for a very long time, he had me until he developed a website and started calling my colleagues and friends and family and walking them to the website to see, wow, these photos. And I knew that I had to take action. Mm-hmm. So I, of course, called police. I, you know, got an attorney and started civil and criminal proceedings. But that's really where this story, where 50 Shades of Silence begins. Because what I discovered is that law enforcement is not adequately prepared to know what to do with victims in this case. They wanted to call mine a citizen's complaint. Mm. I mean, seriously, and it wasn't going to go anywhere. And then I'm still in court seeking what should be a simple protection from abuse / cyber stalking. But because mine is an international case, we're hung up on red tape around jurisdiction as to whether or not the state can protect me. Mm. And so it should be very simple with all of the evidence that I have and all of the, right, threats and all of the photos that the courts have seen, that it should be without question. But because it's not a clear linear line that a judge can rule on, and the judge in my case even said, you're my first cyber harassment case. I'm not quite sure what to do with this. Mm. I'm very aware of the fact that we need change in this area. I'll take this one step further, and as I even engaged with authorities in Jamaica, they told me to mail my cell phone and my laptop so they could investigate it, and they could have it for up to a year.
Right.
Now, yeah, who's, right, going to do that? Mail it to another country.
Right.
Go get his. He's got the one who has the evidence, right, on, and besides, I'd given them all of that. But you have to understand, that's just how crazy this is. And to think that you have to submit your devices for computer forensic investigation as the victim further victimizes the victim.
Right.
So it became very clear to me that I needed to speak up about this. So I'm now using my voice, my story, and my platform to film a documentary, to tell this story, to call for, as an advocate, tougher legislation, and to really promote this sense of social responsibility.
Your circumstance, oh, my mind is reeling, because you're touching on so many things. I think of Professor Crenshaw's intersectionality. You've just brought up a whole new level or wrinkle on that concept, because with an internet, you know, we come on, I joke about us being intergalactic because we got the internet. Well, the law and regulations and procedures got to catch up with the world.
Oh,
you know, these barriers don't mean anything anymore. Okay, you're in another country, so what? I can contact you just like we're sitting right, you know, like we're in each other's face-to-face talking to each other. So now it's a different situation. When are the jurists going to catch up, the lawmakers going to catch up?
Never. Never, because we are at the moment in time where we're now still litigating, and not we, but our lawmakers are still litigating and trying to rule and pass on bills that were introduced 4 or 5 years ago, and now they're old,
mm-hmm,
because they were drawn with, you know, jurisdiction issues. And we realize that, you know, some of the case statutes in some states allow for the victim to go after some form of punishment, but only if their perpetrator was in that state. Now, come on, we're on the internet. I mean, they could be across the country or, in my case, across the world. So, you know, you don't have any teeth in the deal.
Pennsylvania would be limited because you were in Ohio.
And also, a lot of these laws on the books are very, very old laws. Some of this stuff goes back hundreds of years.
Well, not in this. Quite frankly, as it relates to cyber, this is what's interesting about cyber. This. Really, they're only about 5 years old, mm-hmm. which is new compared to, like you said, the books. What's on the books from hundreds of years. So we're dealing with a relatively new issue that still does not have enough teeth in the deal. Basically, in some states, it's a $500 fine. Well, people are committing suicide, losing their jobs, mm-hmm. losing their livelihood. And after you spend $5,000 in court, you might get a $500 judgment in your favor.
Yeah, what we're looking at, I mean, this is like the updated version of it all. But what we're looking at is like hundreds of years of oppression, you know, started by white males that have spread throughout the world. And this is become part of the system. It's part of the judicial system. It goes against women when women are trying to, like, deal with their children in the courts. It's like a whole lot of things that are they're very oppressive in this whole situation. Like, you and I were talking last week briefly about this. And it doesn't mean that all the brothers are off the hook. Not at all, because we shouldn't be doing this anyhow. You know, our mothers told us when we were raised, if you can't treat your sister right, you know, you can't, you know, you need to treat another woman like you would treat your sister. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Or your mom or whatever.
Right, right.
I think the basic principle is how we treat each other, regardless. You know, I'm still trying to figure it out whether I'm a cis male or all, you know, you got to keep up. So I'm trying to struggle with all of that kind of stuff. But it doesn't matter. We all came here the same way. And if you're from a certain religious tradition, you believe all of us are the children of God. So by what right does anybody treat anybody as lesser or come here with a built-in, I'm superior to you? And I think that starts the basic problem. Paternalistic, patriarchy, that's a big problem, very big problem. Maybe it'll start to change. I noticed a congressman the other day had some pictures put out on the internet. Mm-hmm. So maybe when the white males start to be victims of this, that's when, you know, when you get gored, you see the other guy say, oh, that's bad, or you laugh, or you don't pay any attention. When it happens to you, it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hate to say, well, we got to wait till some of them get in trouble. But the point, I think, is that folks, particularly the younger generation, a lot of them, not all of them, because there were some young people in that Nazi march and stuff, unfortunately, but got a whole different sense of the world and what our worth is and what have you. So I want to commend you, Darius, on what you're doing. Your website, your organization, do people join? Do you become members or...
So you can go to 50shadesofsilence.com, and that's 50shadesofsilence.com. Leave us your name and email address and be a part of our movement. And that looks like a lot of different things. It could simply be to just share the message so that someone out there who might be experiencing some form of abuse or assault, mm-hmm. Or victimization is aware of the resources that we have at our website. And they include a number of different things: how to get help, how to get support, how to get your content taken down and removed. I used a takedown service to have the website shut down that hosted my content. Mm-hmm. Many people are not aware of that process, or even how to get images and content removed off social media. So we provide step-by-step guides to that. There's a 1-800 number there, so if victims want to talk with someone, you can. Mm-hmm. We also have ways for you to get involved with the movement, and that could look like donating, which would be fantastic, because all of this, including the website and the documentary, takes funds. And so we are calling on people to make donations. That would be fantastic. But even becoming an angel ambassador. When the film is complete, one of my goals is to host community screenings, to have people host community screenings. So you can you know, rent out a theater and have people come in and watch the film. And afterwards, open up the floor for post-discussion. We'll provide a syllabus with talking points and intended invited guests. So we're moving this forward from a very educational standpoint. In addition to that, I want to produce an educational version that would also be made available for schools and universities and online with additional resources as well.
I'm smiling because I work at the community college.
Great.
And I was getting ready to say, we'll have to figure out how to get to that audience.
Yes. And I'm working with a number of different schools and universities and school and church groups, and because this is very much a grassroots movement. We are at a tipping point in this whole social space where change must happen before we see greater degrees of online violence and victimization. And so it really is about getting people to see those people who don't think it's serious, understanding that while you may not be impacted, your child, your parent, your neighbor, someone may be. So what does that mean? How do they get help and resources? That's what the website is there for. It's also a place where people who want to share their stories with us can do so safely. Because what I know more than anything is that when a victim has the chance to speak out and to get support and have someone hear them, that is how you start to crack the veil of silence. And hopefully they're able to find a way to release the shame, the pain, and the guilt, and find the courage to move forward. And more importantly, I mean, I think this resides from what I do as a coach, that's important to do. But what I know from being a victim, that is a way to heal. And we will look at that in the film, but we'll also make those resources available at the website. And, you know, I'm speaking, I'm traveling the country to get this message out. So it is very much a part of my next chapter in life.
All right. Well, great. I was just thinking, it's one thing to suffer, but it is many times worse to suffer alone.
Mm.
And a lot of tragic things, from suicide to, I frankly think, some of these incidents of violence that happen where somebody goes against someone else and does whatever, just physically attacks them with their hands, or even, unfortunately, with the proliferation of guns, that there's a lot of stuff that happens. When they study the background of a lot of these folks who have done some of these heinous crimes, they have found abuse as a child. So they're acting out and reacting to situations that they have suffered in silence.
You bring up a very interesting point. I interviewed a psychologist and psychotherapist who I asked, I need to understand the mind of the person who does this.
Mm-hmm.
The sociopathic, narcissistic mind of the person who says, I am going to exact this pain and assault and violence against you. And she made it very clear to say, that's because in many instances, these are hurt people who hurt people. Mm-hmm. That in somewhere, perhaps in their childhood, they did not experience the type of love and support that they need. And they somewhere in their minds was the switch that it's okay for me to exact pain on someone else when I feel a sense of pain. And while I am not a psychologist or psychotherapist and can't even begin to understand the mindset of this, I do get that. And one of the goals that I hope as I extend this message around the world is this sense of compassion. While victims may not be ready to forgive the person who's hurt them, if you can at least find an extension of compassion and some sort of understanding, that takes a little bit of the pressure off of you trying to get through it for yourself. And certainly if you can get to the place of forgiveness, then that's even better. And it's not easy to do, but it's something that I think if people are able to make that bridge and get to the other side would be very healthy for them.
So last few minutes we've talked about one side of your passion. The other side is hustle. Why now's the time to unleash your passion? How do people get the book?
Yeah, right at my website, DarethChisholm.com. You can also get it on Amazon, but right at DarethChisholm.com. And I love the book for a lot of different reasons. It really, if you are in business or looking to start a business, it's a very practical step-by-step motivational guide to doing that. I also include several interviews with other very successful entrepreneurs who give some tips and resources and information. And I'm quite proud of the work that I did to pour into that book and the feedback that I get from people. So the book's available at my website. More information about my coaching services as well as some of the other programs that I offer at DarriethChisholm.com. And, of course, at 50shadesofsilence.com, we welcome everyone. We're on social media on all our channels at 50 Shades of Silence as well as I am at Darieth Chisholm. So I hope folks will like me, tweet me, post me, whatever.
All right. That's great. Again, you're just such an inspirational figure, person.
Thank you.
And I hope people are paying attention. And, in fact, I don't need to hope. I know they are. I guess what I'm saying is more of you, if you're out there listening and you don't know, you should be kind of hip to it now, if I can use a term. That's old, but I still like it. I think it functions well. That you've been given a taste of what is available, the power that you have within yourself, even if you're at, what's the term they use now from the movie, in a sunken place, that you can get out of that. You know, it doesn't have to end in a negative kind of way, that you don't have to just always be in a funk and a fuss, but there are ways, there are pathways, there are people who help you get out of it.
You can
that's
turn
what's
your,
important.
Yeah, you can turn your pain into your passion. You can turn your mess into your mission, and you can turn your turmoil into something terrific for yourself and for others. And that is a process, but that's part of the work that I do as a coach. But also what I know is the path out of the silence. So I encourage anyone who is in that place to reach out to us or find someone to talk to and begin to use what I call everyday courage and find your way out.
Darieth Chisholm, thank you for being you and thank you for doing all that you do. And I don't have to say keep doing it because I know you will.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, no problem. And anytime there's something you're doing.
I'll be back when the movie's released.
Absolutely.
Doing the film premiere here in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I'll be back to tell you listeners about it.
All right. Reserve a ticket for me. I'll be there.
All right.
Absolutely. Claire, do you think we could play some music this time? I'm joking because we always go many times. I forget. I just go on the roll. And then it's like, we have no time. And I'm like, let's play the record. Of course, we'll be back next Wednesday. Brother Amos.
Yeah.
Thank you for hooking this up.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
It's always good to see you. You've been so busy lately.
When I first saw Darieth on Lynn's show,
mm-hmm.
I was just totally devastated by her story. But then I'm like, well, we need to get her on the air and talk about this because we had already started talking about this anyhow.
Right.
You know, right. With all the different things in the news these days. So, but I wanted to keep the information flowing and provide an outlet for Darieth to get the word out about what she's doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is just the beginning of continuing collaboration. How about that?
Right.
All right. Let's have some music. That's what you gave me. We'll see you next week, 6 p.m. EST.
Thank you.
Do you worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
We got a right to the tree of life. and all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. We got a right to the tree of life and all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. We got a right to the tree of life and all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. Tell the world, facing hatred, breaking down the walls.
Tell the world,
standing together as the symbols fall.
Tell the world,
raising our voices for one and all.
Together we're on our way. We got a right to the tree of life, and all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. We got a right to the tree of life. And all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. Tell the world.
Showing respect for every human soul.
Tell the world.
We're reaching out to young and old.
Tell the world.
Singing will heal us, it will make us whole.
Together we're on our way. We got a right to the tree of life. And all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. We got a right to the tree of life. And all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. Tell the world.
We have a legacy to leave behind.
Tell the world.
A better future for our kids to find.
Tell the world.
We're not afraid so we can speak our minds.
Together we're on our way. We got a right to the tree of life. And all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. We got a right to the tree of life. And all that love can give us. We're not afraid to shine our light. We're here to tell our story. Tell the world. 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 Tell the world.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
Tell me about it. Did you have any idea that was going on?
None. I mean, you saw Derek at the game last night, too. Did you have a clue?
No. But you know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do. Kids hear first about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
It can be hard to tell sometimes. But if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, bullying, violence, anything, you need to tell an adult. Mom or me, a teacher, coach, school counselor, someone you know and trust.
Dad, no kid is gonna tell an adult about that kind of stuff.
I get it, but if we don't know, we can't help. Speaking up about a problem, that's what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
I can't stop. You got just my back inside. You know my head don't hurt me, baby. Honey, just my back inside. Tell that doctor come. He may cool my fever. Lord, tell that doctor come. Lord, he may cool my fever. Lord, tell the doctor come. She got a few dimes. Lord, don't mistreat nobody, baby, cause you got a few dimes. Lord, you must always remember you ain't gonna be up all the time. Oh, you ain't gonna be up all the time. Lord, remember, Lord, you ain't gonna be up all the time. Promise my baby, I'm gonna buy a V-Ray 4. Lord, I promise my baby, I'm gonna buy a V-Ray 4. Promise me, baby, how you gonna stay right home? Yeah, you promise me, Lord, you gonna stay right home, Lord, Lord.
Everybody wants to be the winner, but nobody wants to play. Yeah, everybody wants.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Out there in Radio Land, in the Republic of Radio Land, next to the ocean of Radio Land. All right, that joke's dead. It is 7 o'clock, more or less. You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. That means it is time for you to be listening to the WRCT radio calendar. Try to make this painless. The Lawrenceville Farmers Market happens on Tuesdays from 3 until 7 p.m. at Arsenal Park, which is at 250 40th Street. Farmers Market hosts over 30 wonderful vendors in Arsenal Park. From now through the fall, rain or shine, 3 to 4 is reserved for shoppers disproportionately affected by COVID-19. I don't know what that means anymore, but, you know, show up when you think you should. For more details, you can call them at 412-802-7220 or send them some email at market@lunited.org.